fundamental things. If you do it carefully, it's always worth doing. And then he helped instill confidence that if even if it's something that's already been well established, if you do it carefully, you might still find something. We'll see. There's a third thing he always advised, and that is do experiments. Now, I'm violating that rule wholesale today. I have no experiment to propose, but I should add that when I was mentioning just one-on-one with him yesterday what I was up to, he listened, and then he says, "Do you have an experiment?" That was his first comment. About the possibility of finding something in areas that are well established, I remember once when we found something that was nice, when he was my advisor, he turned to me after people were surrounding him at a physics meeting and were all enthusiastic about the nice thing we had found, about Bell's theorem, and after the crowd dispersed, he leaned over and he said, I've mentioned this in the past, he leaned over and said, "Even the blind chicken occasionally finds a kernel of corn." But today, there's a chance that you might just watch the blind chicken peck on clean dirt, and you can see there's no corn there, but we'll see. Okay, why this topic, given that I said I knew nothing about it? Personal background was a contributor. For years, with some of my longtime collaborators, Anton and Danny and Herb Bernstein and Abner, we were working with neutron interferometry. It was a period of more than a decade between the Bell physics period of my life and then returning to the Bell physics later in the past 15 years or so. And it was a period there where we were doing single particle interferometry with neutrons. And in the course of doing that, we did dozens of experiments, many of them at MIT, and a few groups around the world were doing them, all similar ones. The general scheme was to perturb these thermal neutron interferometers with various external influences, magnetic fields, electric fields, rotations, motions, turning them on their side, inserting moving matter into the interferometers. And so it turned out that in about half of the experiments we considered over those years, and did many of them, we had to do relativity with Schrodinger Drolli waves. That came up when the interferometer was either rotated or accelerated or turned up sideways in the gravity field. The matter that was inserted into the interferometer was set in motion. All of these would produce phase changes, and we had to calculate them. And it turned out when we worked it turned out though that since they were thermal neutrons, the relativity that we had to worry with in the quantum mechanical context was always Galilean. And it was remarkably hard. I remember that in the beginning there was very little literature that addressed the problem, for example, of Galilean invariance of Schrodinger Drolli waves, or transformation, I should say, not invariance, but transformations. I remember, does anybody remember, was it Levi LeBlanc? He had a nice paper back, I think it was the early 70s. And then Danny, even before I got into it, Danny was into particularly the interferometry and a gravity field problem, which by equivalence is equivalent to an accelerating one. But it was very messy in the Galilean transformation properties of Schrodinger waves. just to show how bad it was, if you have the wave function in one Galilean frame, the transform is not the wave function in another Galilean frame. Extra phase factors pop up. So in the back of my mind during the times we were working on this, I often wondered, what it's like if we were to do real relativity. So that's one of the motivations. It had been in the back of my mind since those years, but I never actually plowed into it. And for some reason, right after school ended this year, I decided I would do that as a topic. So it's a stimulating thing to do, by the way, to announce a topic, give an abstract 2 months before a meeting on something you haven't done. It's fun. What quantum mechanics, right? What quantum mechanics do I need to consider? Well, it's clear that I want a quantum state that's spatially extended, you know, that occupies a lot of space time. So I think I'm inevitably going to be talking about just center of mass motion of free particle, you know, in force free space. So a free particle with no forces on it. But just a single momentum state, you know, which occupies all of space throughout all of time, right? It lasts forever and is everywhere. A single momentum state won't do because it has no features. That is, it's uniformly bright. The probability density is uniform throughout the whole of space-time. So it has to be at least a little richer than that, so it has something to look at. So it seemed clear that the obvious choice was Young's fringes, because Young's fringes are just the superposition of two momentum states. And it makes these beautiful stripes that have been seen, you know, if with the right radiation, not with neutrons, but with light, you can see them on a paper, sheet of paper, if the light's bright enough. And they've been seen for over 200 years. That's why I call them Young's fringes. He didn't know about the particle aspect of the things he was looking at, but we now know about it. And the same experiment has now been done with, well, I don't know, at least six or eight types of fundamental particles. Initially electrons, and after the photons, and then neutrons in the 70s, and atoms in the 80s, and molecules and very large molecules recently. So people make Young's fringes. And what are they? They're essentially the field that's produced far beyond two slits when illuminated with monoenergetic radiation, whatever the type. And if the radiation is bright enough, you can actually see them, possibly with your eye, if the right radiation, or you can detect them with the right detectors. And they have a feature. How wide are the stripes? Right, they have a feature. So I decided that if I wanted to talk about looking at basic quantum mechanics in a bad frame, that should be what I should look at least at the one particle level. Now, if I was successful there, then I thought I would turn to two particle, because we know entanglement can also be done not just with spin or polarization, but as several people have talked about, as Espe was talking about today, it can be done with center of mass position. That is, you can entangle momentum states for two particles. So that produces Young's fringes that I call two-particle Young's fringes. Now, they're interesting in that they don't exist. That is, if you have the right, if you have the radiation that I'm talking about now, whatever the nature of the particle, again, its prototype is two slits and a viewing screen. If you have that kind of two-particle radiation, what it means is that you know one of the particle passed through one, and if it did, the other one passed through the other, but you don't know which went through which. So it's a superposition of those two possibilities. There's other possibilities. You could know that they both went through one. You just don't know which one it was that they both went through. So you get interesting entanglements either way. So this produces a two-particle entanglement. And if you look on a screen and just detect particles, there's no structure. You just, I'll count particles along this viewing screen, and it is flat. But once you catch a particle, one of them, then you look for the twin, it will form a fringe. Just as striking as the original single particle fringes, but they don't exist except conditionally. So I figured that's the two spatially extended examples I would work with. They were the simplest ones I knew at the one particle and the two particle level. So I wanted to look at that from a frame that's non-inertial. So what frame? I didn't really tell you enough about that. Why this topic? I left out one reason besides a neutron background. I was curious. I just wondered what it looked like, because you'll see. So anyway, what frame? They can be identical. If you need to, you can imagine that they are distinguishable. You still just don't know which route which one of them took. It still occurs. So what frame? What non-inertial frame? Well, here, this is where I was really a novice. So I figured it should be the simplest non-inertial frame, cleanest, simplest non-inertial frame I could find, okay? And I'll tell you what that one is. It had to be roughly what you would consider a uniformly accelerating frame. But in real relativity, you have to be careful when you talk about a uniformly accelerating frame. So there's the introduction. So I could have put this up earlier. Up there, I'm just depicting the frames I'm going to use. And there's a depiction of, say, the single particle fringes, if you wish, that probably wouldn't depict the conditional fringes for two particles, because they're not there until you catch the first one, and then they form. And they're not centered at any particular spot. But I've shown so think of that as single particle fringes. And it's what's plotted there is just the count rate along an axis drawn on the viewing screen. And I've placed the zero of this axis underneath one of the brightest spots in the count rate. And that x-axis I'm taking to be an inertial frame. The radiation that's falling on it is, as described, just two crossing amplitudes associated with a single particle, the two-slit experiment. The non-inertial frame I have in mind, I want it to move as follows. I want it to I call it the X prime. I want it to slide in from the right relative to the original one up at the top. And why not? Let's have it, as it slows down, have these zeros coincide at the time when the time is zero in the original inertial frame. And at that time, when the zeros coincide and the second frame has stopped, I see nothing to prevent me in plane relativity. I see nothing to prevent me from zeroing all the clocks that are riding the X prime axis, right, that are positioned at places on the X prime axis. So everything is zeroed when the X prime has stopped. Okay. Now, what detailed motion do I want to impart to it so that I can handle it? Right. Now, when I say handle it, I want to be able to do the mechanics, either the classical or when I turn to the quantum, I want to be able to handle it exactly. That is, I want to avoid to first order, to second order. I want all the square roots, all the gammas, and all the betas, to stay throughout. So I wanted to do real relativity really accurately. So my motion of my moving frame has to be neat. So let me show you the one that I turned to. Now, the name might catch your attention before I tell you what the motion is. When I was a sophomore at the University of Mississippi, and I was taking my third semester of physics, after I think the first year was Halliday and Resnick, right? It was like 1961, 62. And then the next fall, we had a little beginner's book on modern physics. I don't know if anybody ever knows this book. The professor's name who wrote it was at Delaware. His name was Van Name. Anybody? Anyway, in his one chapter was devoted to relativity for beginners, and he had a couple of problems in there that I don't see show up very much in at least the undergraduate relativity texts that are on my shelf, but they seem like the ideal problems to start with, and it was the following. I call it Van Name motion because he was just the author of that textbook. And it's not about a moving frame, it's about a moving particle. So forget the particle, but for right now, let's just talk about it as though I had a particle. I'm not going to accelerate any particles, all right? So the problem he had in his elementary book was consider a particle of some rest mass and experiencing a constant force. I should have put an F down there. It might be down there. No, I left it off. Anyway, the mass and the force are m naught and f. And here's the details of the problems he presented. There's the position at time t, the speed at time t, but written as a beta, you know, a speed over c. The acceleration at time t, and you can note that the acceleration is not constant. It diminishes as time passes, as it had to be consistent with relativity. And finally, the speed is repeated as a function of the position down at the bottom. So there's those four equations sort of capture the motion in detail. I'm using these dimensionless coordinates for all the positions and the times. So you see all the positions are measured in units of distance, m naught c squared over f. That's the unit that's being used to make them dimensionless. So it's the distance this force would have to act on your body to impart rest mass worth of energy, additional energy to it. And the t is also dimensionless in the same fashion. The conventional t is in units of m naught c over the f. And then in the third equation, I put in the acceleration parameter, let's call it. I realize if I really were a student of general relativity, I would have put a G there. I learned that a few weeks later. A little G would be traditional. But the point is, I'm not interested in moving a particle like this. So I don't have an F, and I don't have an M naught. If I had an M naught, it would be what it would be my frame. If you imagine the frame was etched on a monolithic stone or something, right? But I don't have it. I just want to accelerate the origin of my prime frame. I want it to give it this motion. I want it to have this motion, okay, so I can deal with it. Down here is just the quick derivation of those. If you take Newton's equation in conventional form and convert it to these dimensionless form, you just get a time differential is the differential of gamma beta, and you integrate it. I'm assuming it starts from rest at t equals zero, and you get the second equation. And then you can you can integrate to go back to the first one or differentiate to go to the third one. And then you can take the first one, the second one, and eliminate the time to get the fourth one. So that's the end of the derivation. Alternatively, you can do the work energy approach to get the fourth one directly. So there it is. But remember, I have no force and I have no mass. All I really need to retain from this is the parameter A naught. Right? I want my origin of my prime frame to move that way. So let's let it move that way. This is the same motion, but just presented in another form. The T is the time in the inertial frame, written as a function of the proper time carried by the point, the moving point, and which I call tau. So I have a moving point if I'm not a moving mass. And the derivation is just the time dilation between the proper time and the inertial frame time integrated. So the equation, it turns out that first equation is just time dilation integrated through a succession of Lorentz frames, right? And the position as a function of the proper time kept by the point is given by that lower equation. And you can derive it from the ones on the previous page and the one up at the top. So there's the same motion, just written in a different way. Now, that's the way I want the origin to slide in and slide out. But then here comes the tricky part. The first tricky part. I want to hang a complete X prime axis on that moving origin. All I've discussed so far is how the origin travels, right? I want to hang an axis on it, a full prime frame axis, and I want to take that proper time that was carried by the origin spot. I want to spread it over the X prime frame. This is not legitimate. There's danger here, The big 1972 Meisner and Thorne and Wheeler devotes a short chapter to this problem, and they're the ones I got this equation from. You can see that they're the ones I had on the previous page, except in front of the hyperbolic trig functions, a one has been changed to one plus the position in the prime frame, in each equation, and. They go through several pages to come up on these equations, and in every other sentence they're warning you about the pitfalls of using these equations. Apparently the main issue is spreading that time, that tau time kept by the origin spot, spreading it all over the frame, which is in verbal terms is essentially what they have done. But they derived the equation after two or three pages of Fermi-Walker transport talk and technical details. So when it comes to my filling in my private derivation, I don't have one. I just borrowed them. But keep the warnings in mind about what you do with them. They are slightly different, though. Their version doesn't have the one, the minus one in the top equation. And that's just a simple shift of the origin in the original inertial frame. Their particle, the spot they watch move, starts at one on their unprimed axis, and mine starts at zero on that axis. So it's just a shift. And the lower pair is just the inverse. Okay, so here's where I started. I treated these in the same fashion you treat the Lorentz transformations of space and time and embark on unfolding special relativity. The top one takes me from x prime and tau to x and t, and the bottom one takes me the other way. They're not nice and linear by any means like those, but there they are, the transforms going either way between space and time. Now, the question that comes up is, why didn't I tidy up the notation? Why didn't I call the tau t prime? So it'd be nice and t prime and x prime and t and x. And that's just to keep the, to help me remember the warnings about those equations. I want that tau to sit there. Say, I'm a tau, and I'm the clock at the origin, and keep that in mind. So I didn't. I kept the notation unsymmetric for that reason. I think that you could probably give some sort of a hand waving derivation. I was thinking about it the last few days. I mean, but it would be a hand wave. You know, it has a lot of properties you'd want it built. You want built in if. Remember, the moving frame stops at T, it stops and all clocks are zeroed there in both frames. And so both tau and T would be zero then. And the top equation tells you that X and X prime are equal, which is the way you want it because they were the origins matched up. Deriving them is another issue. One of those things I promised I don't know about. So treating them like I said, treating them like a Lorentz transformations and embarking on finding their consequences. I had three, I called them disappointments. Did I spell that right? Three consequences might have been better, but I found them disappointing when I first found them, right? Because they caused me grief for weeks. So here's the things that fold out. You know, all you do is take the transformations on the previous transparency and just take differentials of them. But you can do the differentials fully, and that'll enable you to derive number two, which is the transformation of speeds. But if you hold some of the variables constant, like up in one, I took the derivative of the inertial coordinate with respect to the inertial frame time while holding the position in the moving frame constant. So that's got to be the speed. That's the speed. It's the speed. I could rewrite it in either coordinates, right? It's the speed of the point on the prime axis that's adjacent to x, coincident with x, at time t, right? And I took the derivative of x prime with respect to the tau, holding the x constant, to get the speed, the relative speed the other way. And there it is. The minus is good. I like that. The t over 1 plus x is good, but the 1 plus x prime is bad. So I put it in red. And the next one is when you take the differentials of the transforms and divide them, and you know, like you were deriving the transformations for special relativity speeds, you get this second equation. And it's a even though And it's just what you would want. U is the speed. I should tell you what U is. I haven't got to my particle yet. I've just been talking about these frames. U is going to be my particle, which initially is going to be classical. Then I'm going to have quantum mechanical amplitudes. And U is just the speed of that particle. When I get to my quantum mechanics, it's actually going to have two speeds with their amplitudes superposed. But U is the particle speed. We're working classically. And the T over 1 plus X that it's compounded with in this equation is the speed of the moving frame. Or the speed with the negative, it's the speed of the inertial frame relative to the moving frame. And so you compound it just like normal special relativity to get the speed in the prime frame, except another ugh, right? It's the same one, 1 plus x prime again. The speeds over there, as I say, they're just the rate of change of x and x prime with respect to the appropriate time scale. And then the last disappointment is that if I use the machinery derived here to compute the momentum of a particle in the prime frame, if I already know its momentum in the initial inertial frame, I can do that in special relativity. I can do that two or three ways. I can transform the energy momentum. I didn't write those down. I can transform the energy momentum to get the momentum in the new frame. Or I can just I can use speed addition to get the speed in the new frame and then just compute the momentum. Now, the momentum is gamma times speed. There's a bracket missing there. It's one of those missing spots. Anyway, so it's gamma times speed times beta. Gamma of beta times beta in the prime frame. And in regular special relativity, you can write that as a product of the two separate gammas that go with the speeds being compounded times the straight classical sum of the speeds. Or here's the difference. And similarly, when you do energy, you can the energy is just the gamma itself. You know, we have not c squared, so it's just the gamma itself. And you can use that identity. So the left and right side of the top equation in number three is two ways to compute the momentum in special relativity. And the bottom one is two ways to compute the energy without using the energy momentum transforms, right? Just working with the definitions of energy and momentum. And what's what? Two. Oh, that should be a C. It's just I'm scratching at the table in the library. It's a C. Thanks. It's a C. There is no V up there. Right. In fact, there's another. It's in two places here. Yeah. Anyway, these identities down here aren't valid, and it's because of that 1 plus x prime in number two. So you get inconsistent values for the energy and similarly for the momentum if you calculate in the two different ways. So three problems, right? Now, I said that you missed, Abner, that I said at the beginning that you weren't responsible for any of this or even involved, which I think you might find reassuring. And that same with Danny and Anton. But I did talk to Herb some because he knows about relativity, and I asked him some astute questions during the last few weeks, like, what's metric, and he was helpful in some of this. Okay, there's the quick fix. One thing fixes all of them. A clock that's carried resting at x prime in the moving frame doesn't keep the tau time. It carries what I'll call the t prime time. So now I've got symmetric notation. And then when you recheck the relative speeds of the frames, they are now equal except for the negative of each other. Right. that fixed the first problem. And when you rederive the speed addition formula, there's a, still got V's up there. I was, had V's in my brain, and they're still up there. Those V's, forget them. Anyway, the bad factor is gone. So relativistic speed addition does work, even though one of the speeds that that's being compounded is time dependent and space dependent, right? It's time and space dependent. And it's the relative speeds of the frame at a particular space-time point, right? And by the way, the U prime here is a different, it's no longer dx prime d tau, it's by definition dx prime dt prime. So it's the, quote, the true speed, the corrected speed. Now I got the speeds right. Now, I don't know whether, to what extent this solves the shortcomings of those equations. I suspect from what I hear about general relativity, it's only the first step, right? That there must be equations similar to that one up there involving links. And it's a full rich option in your geometry, right? But I've made this one correction that puts everything in order at this level, even though I don't know the inadequacies of this level fully. And finally, the speed addition formulas, they get corrected. They become those identities are restored. Now, I was, by the way, the fix, of course, is just what we call the general relativity time effect due to elevation. That is, as you go upward in the X prime frame, opposite to the effect of gravity force, clocks run at a faster rate, and if you go down, they run at a slower rate. So to what extent is this any one or some combination of these, to what extent is it a derivation of that effect? And I think it's not, because I think Vail said in another context one time when he was criticizing previous hidden variable proofs from the past, it's not a logical necessity of thought that we retain relative speed of the frames necessarily, right? It could be that we lose that. It's not a logical necessity of thought that the speed addition formula works when you have speeds that are space-time dependent. You know, you just have to go elsewhere. So I don't think you can consider these a derivation, so that a separate derivation is needed. A justification. Again, I just used it. But then this brings me to where I realized that I have lots of questions here. I want to pursue this longer. Like, it's understandable that the clock located at a particular X prime could keep a different rate because it's a non-inertial frame, could keep a different rate than it would if it's located in another X prime, right? Because it's a very strange frame that I'm not accustomed to. And the X prime, by the way, that this time rate correction depends on both the product of the conventional position X prime and the acceleration parameters, the product of them, you know, as you know from the general relativity effect. Since it depends on those, I said, oh, a natural clock, that is a clock that you haven't tampered with. Oh, by the way, for a while I thought about, I could have the clocks that I zeroed on the X prime frame at the moment it screeched to a halt. I'm free to doctor them. Right, I can do whatever I want to them, you know. I can bias them linearly in time in space if I want to. I built them. I'm the physicist, right? But I felt that there was something here about what a clock naturally does. So then I said, oh well, it's not unreasonable. I initially said it's not unreasonable that a clock at X prime could know that it's in an accelerating frame because it could be an accelerometer and it could sense that it needs to adjust. That is, it could know a naught. But how would it know where it is? Right? How would the clock know that, oh, I'm at X prime? No, that particular X prime. It's got to know how far it is from the reference spot, which was the origin. And that seems to require communication. Right? There's got to be some communication between the reference space-time point and the clock whose rate we want to correct. So there's more there. But I haven't done it. By the way, the Wheeler book, every other sentence says, be careful with these equations. Be careful with these equations. But anyway, the fix got me back in operation, right? I don't know exactly how far I can use these equations, that is, how big an X prime I can use, right? And lots of other questions I'll mention near the end. So anyway, I'm ready to do the quantum mechanics, and this goes fast because it turns out these two subjects fit together nicely. I mean, just unlike Schrodinger wave mechanics and Galilean relativity, which don't fit together, right? These go together nicely. So there's my two counterpropagating single particle amplitudes, and there's the Young's pattern that they produce, written out in general terms without being specific what the momenta and the energies are in each of the terms. I call them right and left, you know, R and L for right and left, because they're going to turn out to be propagating right and propagating left in my inertial frame, symmetric in fact. But they could stand for any two momenta and appropriate energies. They could both be going right or both left. So the pattern is a cosine fringe pattern, and it depends on this capital phi. So let's work out that capital, that critical phase factor that makes the fringes. Let's work it out for three frames. First, in my original inertial frame that was fixed to the fringes were not moving. There's what that capital angle is, and it's the familiar expression from de Broglie particle interference. It includes the factor over there of it includes a relativistic U over C factor, a length contraction. It's not one that's I don't think anybody's ever picked up that length contraction for any of the electrons or neutrons or atoms because they're extremely slow, and so it doesn't actually appear. But you remember, I wanted to keep everything and not go to first order or second order. So there's the width of the fringes, and it has a relativistic length contraction, and it's in the right direction. W naught is a, I'll just save that for future reference. It's the width of the fringes in the frame of the fringes, right? It's the width of the frame of the fringes. Okay. Then I went to, just as practice to check my machinery, I went to another inertial frame of moving right at speed v before I get to my frame of interest, right? Just a Lorentz frame. And there's the phase in that frame. And you can compute the width, and it's the same width we had up at the top, but contracted because of the speed v. So if you looked at Young's fringes from a steadily moving frame, they will contract, which I thought was good. It's the way they're supposed to, that's what I wanted to find. I was wondering, I was looking at David Berman's new book on It's About Time, and at the end when he discusses how does it all come about, these effects, he stresses that length contraction and time dilation and all the magic of relativity. These are real. These things really do contract. It's not like they appear to contract. And that if you have the relevant relativistic theory to describe the object you're considering, be it a clock or a stick, you can actually show how it comes about. And I was thinking that this might be a demonstration of one of those sorts. It's a very elementary one, because the stick that I'm considering is a very subtle stick. It is nothing but the fringe width of some Young's fringes. And this is the detailed explanation of how the contraction comes about, really. It seems very close to almost nothing, doesn't it? In other words, you don't have to put anything in. It's just there it is. And then here's the punchline for the one particle. There should be a prime on number 3. It's a new frame, not the top one. The expressions are exactly the same, except the V over C gets replaced by that relative speeds of the coordinates, which is space-time dependent. Oh, by the way, I didn't mention the fringe speed in number 2. I just glossed right over it. If you just ask what motion you have to do of x prime, there should be primes on that dx dt prime. What motion you have to do in the frame to keep the fringes abreast of you, it's the speed of the frame you've jumped into with a negative, so it's all right. Down here, the same behavior. The fringes have the space-time dependent speed, and the fringes and the fringes have the space-time dependent contraction. So this, to some extent, was what I embarked on trying to investigate. It's a combination of trivial and incomplete, right? Right. Because I use those equations. So it's still an interesting thing to me. Trivial but wrong. Right? Something's still wrong. The two particle fringes. I have here a standard sort of two particle spatial entanglement. The state of the pair particles 1 and 2 is a sum of products of right and left propagating and a left and right propagating. So if you let the two particles have the same mass and restrict myself to equal and opposite speeds for building my states, plus and minus u, in the non-inertial frame, there's the phase that goes into the cosine. And I've taken the liberty, because I found out that this worked in many past examples when I was trying to reproduce quantum optics people's calculations of the effects they saw doing down conversion experiments, you know, like Mandel experiments of dips and things. So I've just introduced a 1 and a 2 position and a 1 and a 2 time. And I'm going to read the psi star psi as a space-time dependent probability density, you know, with 4 arguments. I know that causes some squeamishness for some folks from past conversations. But anyway, if I take psi star psi and integrate over one of the particles, either over one cycle of space or one cycle of time, because it's a cosine and it's linear in these coordinates and times. If you go over one cycle, you get a constant. So I'm not worrying about normalization. I'm doing something like normalization over a period. So everything just goes in. It's not equal to. So the density of catching particle 2 at x2 and t2 is constant. like I said in the beginning, if you just run a detector along and look for particles, the count rate has no structure at all. It's just flat until you got out of the realm where the fringes exist, which undoubtedly in the real world you would get beyond their ends. Because of that, I can contemplate what the conditional looks like for catching, say, the second particle having caught the first particle at some space-time point. And that's the joint distribution over the singles. And because the singles is a constant, psi star psi is also the conditional. Right? It's not just the joint. You can also use it to compute, if I were to catch one of the particles at a space-time point, then where will the other one be distributed in space-time? And without going through the details, it's all just what you would want. That is, fringes form, because once you catch one of the particles, all of the particle two coordinates are some time in position or some value, so that just makes a constant. And then the fringes are present for the other particle. The conditional fringes are present, and they're peaked. They're peaked right at that moment at the place where you caught the particle. And then all hell breaks loose, right? They start moving, right? They move on and go their own way. But with the right width and with the right speeds, it's just like on the previous page. Everything moves at the right speed with the right width and the right location, right? That is, this materializing conditional fringe materialize at the with peaks at the right space-time points, and then is on its way. So that's it. I didn't realize when I started that it would be such a, except for getting through the three disappointments, but that was fixed pretty quickly. I didn't realize that it would be so neat after my experiences with Galileo and quantum mechanics. The machinery is really quite hanged together. There's still lots of questions that I think I'll pursue, and that is, notice that I got the non-inertial frame wave function by just transforming the inertial frame wave function. But one should be able to have addressed this system by initially finding themselves in that non-inertial frame, which undoubtedly would be a frame with some sort of a gravitational field in it. And how would you come to the same conclusion starting from scratch there, not having worked the other one out and just transformed it, right? The easy route that I took. So that raises the question of, what wave equation, you know, what partial differential equation am I using? Notice the way I proceeded. I didn't need to announce it explicitly, but since I was using E squared equals B squared plus M squared throughout, the equation is undoubtedly the free, back in the inertial frame, it's the free Schrodinger relativistic equation. Is that the same as the one they call Klein-Gordon? The same equation. Anyway, it's just the equation you get out of turning that into a quantum equation, E squared equals P squared plus C squared, but not in the Dirac fashion, right? What I was wondering is, in the accelerating frame, exactly what does the force field look like? I'm not sure that it's constant. Is it a Do you know Herb? I'm not sure. I have the machinery, so within the limitations of these equations, I can work it out and see what it looks like. So, and I know that from looking at Schiff on the relativistic Schrodinger equation, that you can put electric scalar potentials and vector potentials into it, so you could probably put gravity into it. But can you put in a scalar potential if you don't have the other part, sort of questions I don't know anything about. So I don't know what my master equation looks like in the bad frame. The other things I was interested in is if I would like to address more specifically the physics behind these systems. That is, here I just assumed the Young's fringes were out there on the screen, and I was looking at them in a good frame, and then I wanted to look at them in a bad frame. And similar with the two particle fringes. But we know in quantum mechanics how these things come to be is when there are a variety of routes for things to get to be in certain places, and thou shalt add the amplitudes, I just had those given to me. But it might be interesting to look at more physical examples. Like, just to give you an example, what if I actually treated the problem through from the production of the pair? That is something like the following. What if I have a single particle that's hanging in space in a Young's fringe? It's a single particle hanging in space with stable Young fringes in some inertial frame, and it decays into a pair. Or it emits, I want two. I could possibly consider an emission, something like an atom emits a pair of photons, so then I'll have three. But I could do two, something that just breaks into two, one of those or another, and then I would be looking from the onset. And also there's momentum recoils, but there's entanglements galore get created, right? Because if I restrict my attention to the decay only emitting to the right and the left direction, it could have been emitted that way, kicking my original parent particle into a particular eigenstate that way, but it could have been emitted that way and kick it this way. So my original fringes, which were stable, won't be stable anymore. So all kinds of things are going to start to happen. And the reason I'm interested in that is nobody knows why we have these fringes. That they're just the way it is with quantum mechanics, but nobody ever explains them, right? I think Vigner one time wrote one of the great problems, and this is in this latest of the 60s. He said, why do we have this Fourier transform structure between position, momentum, position in time and energy and momentum? It's the part of the gospel of quantum machinery. Does anybody really know why we have it? That's why I want to keep playing. Thanks. Yes. Oh, I mean, for the Klein-Gordon equation, that's probably the equation I'm using, and I have the wrong expression for the density? Oh, that's significant. Thank you. Can anybody confirm that? So what does the correct one look like? So could you write it down for me? Okay. Okay, that's my next step. Yep. before he launches into field theory, right? Yeah. Yeah, thank you. If you have two plane waves combined, the probability density goes negative. Well, it didn't go negative in mine because I'm using the wrong density, huh? Uh-huh. So what's the solution to the negative problem? Okay. So state the conclusion. I should stop. Just go with the other one. Yeah. Okay. Thank you. Danny? At the non-relativistic limit. And a residue makes it through in the phase. Yeah. Thanks.